Welcome to The Last Thing I Saw. This is an episode that is a double feature, I guess, of festing, festing at home and on the road. And to help me in this double coverage is Eric Hines, curator of film at the Museum of the Moving Image. Hello.
How you doing?
I am good. And you are recently back from the True False Film Fest.
Indeed.
So having been there myself and just not able to go this year, I know that that is a pretty much a full on few days while you're there.
It sure is. You know, festivals can be absorbing and exhausting regardless, but True False has the advantage of having kind of a culture of camaraderie, but also a culture of actually watching movies too. It's not an industry festival in the sense that you go there to schmooze necessarily or to make deals or to buy films. It's more about watching films and hanging out with filmmakers. So by nature, that's kind of from the moment you leave the hotel room to the second you get back on the plane afterwards. It's pretty constant, but great. There's a good reason why it's so many people's favorite.
Yeah, and they do a significant number of world premieres and also collect films from Sundance and IDFA and more further flung nonfiction and hybrid film fests. You know, I was very curious just looking at the slate, what were highlights for you? Or because you actually go there with like a dual purpose in the sense that you're watching movies, but you're also participating in this, I don't even know what to call it. If I call it a conference, I feel like that sounds too dry for all that it does.
Yeah. The Boats Conference, right? Based on a true story conference, which happens at the journalism school at the University of Missouri, kind of right before, you know, day and a half before the festival begins and spills over into the beginning of the festival, which kind of takes advantage of the fact that so many people are coming in for the festival, including filmmakers, and kind of bringing them to the university, which is right there in town. The campus sort of extends into town and vice versa. And it started, I think, years ago as more of a conference where the parallel tracks were coming together and separation of journalism and documentary film is discussed and various topics are broached. It's become over the last few years, with Robert Greene being at the Murray Center for Documentary Journalism, a bit more, as you hinted at, more active and demonstrative than it is kind of more like panels. There are some panels, but even when there are panels, it tends to be more focused on particular examples, like diving deeper into a film so that you can get a little past kind of more abstract conversation.
Yeah. Part of the reason I wanted to mention is because one thing in particular sounded pretty cool. Something with Lana Wilson, whose film at Sundance, Look Into My Eyes, was a big favorite of mine there. What was it exactly?
Big favorite of mine as well. It was the Friday morning, the kind of last part of Boats, where the concept was to for Lana and I to talk about the making of Look Into My Eyes and the idea of making a documentary film with subjects and conversations that are completely unverifiable, right? Because people are talking about the beyond. And the way that it was approached was to bring in a local psychic from Colombia, who was akin to the subjects of Lana's film, but not a storefront psychic, somebody who does longer sessions, kind of does a deeper dive and with the people, the clients, the people who come in. And she was fantastic. And she was basically in the room giving readings. And she gave Lana a reading and she gave three students a reading. And then she ended up giving me a reading. But in the midst of this, Lana was directing a shoot of it in the middle of the room. So Stephen Mang, who's the co-director of Union, also was the cinematographer for Look Into My Eyes. And the two of them collaborated in front of us on creating basically over the course of an hour and a half, a two camera fully lit setup. And we had a conversation about what they were doing. And also referencing back to the making of the film. It started with Lana sharing failed test shoots, different ways of approaching the subject that didn't work for her. Well, I should say the sessions themselves, which are not the entirety of the film, but the sessions themselves, how she shoots that, she pretty much replicated in front of us and walked us through the reasons for it, the technical advantages, the technical challenges, and also kind of how she worked with the subjects to get what wound up in the film.
I can't resist asking, can you like share a bit of some of the choices that she made? You know, I mean, like, because that was part of the thing in the interviews, that movie, it's just... it shows how much that can affect things. I guess there's the lighting involved. I was kind of curious about her lens choice as well and other things like that.
One thing that wound up being an advantage is that it was made during, I wouldn't say the early, but kind of the later time of the pandemic, when a lot of the psychics she was working with did not actually have access to their own offices. So there was an opportunity to kind of create spaces, which was a huge advantage in terms of the lighting and the positionality of stuff. So in a sense, I think she was committed to using real spaces, but when that wasn't even possible, it then, it afforded that opportunity. And yeah, she determined that the main thing that she was going for was to get as close to a proper eye line of the clients as possible. That became really, really important for what she wanted to do emotionally. So they're not looking to the camera, but it's pretty close. Like you are seeing them look into the eyes of the psychics off screen, but our eye line is pretty close. That tension of being close was a big goal, it seems. Similarly, there's not a similar eye line for looking at the psychics. In some ways, looking toward the side or more toward the side was where she landed there. And there are a lot of two shots as well of seeing one at either end of the frame and lighting to make it look like it's not lit. You know, so it's really quite elaborately lit, but constructed to make it look otherwise.
Well, actually, maybe that in a way can lead us to one of the films in the True False selection that also actually is going to be at First Look, which is coming right up right there at MOMI, and that's Flying Lessons. That's partly because I think it finds its own way of getting very intimate with its subject, and also because there's some, I mean, not psychic, but artistic, intuitive energy in its subject going on. Yeah, I wonder if you can start us off on Flying Lessons.
I love that point of comparison. Yeah. So Flying Lessons, a film by Elizabeth Nichols, and it did world premiere at True False, and the next stop is indeed First Look at the museum in a week. It's about Philly Abe, a downtown underground New York artist of some note within those circles, actor, musician, fine artist, performer, agitator, a defiant figure. And it necessarily traces within the film the relationship between Elizabeth Nichols and Philly Abe, as well as goes casts back into Philly's career, which is kind of almost exclusively comes through her storytelling and through the archive of her performances, both in films and in concert footage. It's the sort of thing where by coming to Philly through this very unique relationship of a neighbor in an apartment building that's in which the tenants are being forced out for gentrification purposes, that's how they come to know each other. And so therefore their intimacy, their very unique intimacy, is a stand-in for ours. You know, we get to know Philly more and more over time as Elizabeth's getting to know Philly, and it becomes extremely intimate by the end. You know, also just extremely funny. You know, Philly's a mercurial figure who kind of goes from deep reflection to bawdy name calling to kind of brilliant reverie, which I think is maybe part of what you're recalling from the film. And it embraces, like, you know, not easy, never easy. And that's sort of part of her deliberate charm. You know, she's not, doesn't offer easy answers, and she's not gonna coddle or, but she's absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, I've found her fascinating too. I mean, of course, there's some just very basic sustenance that I need now again of like New York, old New York, or whatever you want to call it, that she provides in just armfuls of it. From what I could tell, I guess she lives maybe just recognizing landmarks around Anthology Film Archives, which doesn't appear in the movie, but the TD Bank next to it appears. So I figured she's somewhere in that neighborhood. And yeah, she's living in this apartment building that the notorious Croman is trying to convert with all these harassing methods of harassment, involving like doing gut renovations right above her head. And she's also sees the filmmaker as like a kindred artist, clearly. And it's kind of fun to see her want to play along and just play. And, with the setups of shots or like seeing what the director needs when she's shooting, are we gonna do this? Are we gonna do this? Leaving her messages saying, I'm gonna be doing this, if you wanna come and find me, I'll be here, that sort of thing. I just really liked watching it. Almost felt sort of collaborative in that way. And That's something that you see her in the process of doing also with just people she works with. I guess there's a filmmaker that she's been working with, if I got this right, since the 80s, I think.
Todd Varro.
Todd Varro, making these, I don't know the best way to characterize them.
They're kind of flaming creatures like Tableau,
Yeah, that's great.
keeping that tradition going.
Yeah. So those are also kind of spliced into the movie as these. I mean, they're more than just showing us clips of stuff that she's made. The way they're positioned in the movie, they're sometimes like just these kind of shuttling into through her mind and memory. And they're at these really like sometimes tender points in the movie, these vulnerable points in the movie. And yeah, she's kind of just makes herself an open book in a just deeply genuine way that is hard to do, and I'm sure it's hard to capture and not simplify in some way. It's really almost a movie I want to see again pretty soon, which I don't always feel just because of that, because her presence is just so, I don't know, I found so compelling.
I have to say, like I've seen it. We actually showed this. I think I mentioned this to you before that we'd shown this as a work in progress at First Look last year, and it was very, very close. But they did the brave thing of kind of opening it back up and making some changes and bringing it to where it is. So I saw it before First Look. I saw it again at First Look. I saw the finished film a couple months ago, and we decided we were just desperate to program it ourselves. And then I watched it again at True False, and so much of it was like I was watching it for the first time. And there's something about somebody this compelling and unpredictable and mercurial that it means that there are these beats that happen that I just didn't even remember. It's an incredibly memorable film, but there's just something about all of it that it's rich enough that I feel like it does bear rewatching. So the fact that you have that impulse, I think is an appropriate one. There are moments that the audience was absolutely uproariously laughing to that are genuinely funny, but they're not even what I remember from the scene. There's so much else going on.
Yeah, it's true. Every movie about, a New York artist, I just feel like you see a lot, and I don't want to like put down any other documentaries on this subject, but it's just hard to like bottle that lightning. And maybe sometimes also the subjects aren't like as available as this one is in every sense, and as still kind of like this lightning rod of energies as Philly Abe is.
And it's also just really, really hard to, which it makes sense to me that it was a long edit. It's hard to honor a subject like that, but also make a film that needs to follow its own rules and work on its own. It's not always the exact same. And it can take a while to sort of shed away the expectations or the nerves that come with doing it right. And I'm sure there's incredible footage that seemed super important to everybody involved and probably remained very, very important that was lost, that was just didn't make the film because it doesn't quite follow the logic of what the completed film is.
And I'll just quickly mention, I probably should have mentioned before, we talked about the films that she made, but she was also like, I guess, a singer in a kind of like punk-ish kind of band. But actually, I don't know, had some really good songs.
Totally. Yeah.
And she's completely unpredictable as a singer too, which is really cool.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, a voice, a tone, unlike anybody I've ever heard, truly. But there's a sequence there where you're talking about the going into the archive of performances and how that seems somehow conjured from her head. You see that in real time when she's listening to some of her music and transporting herself back into who she was when she made it, and it bringing up so much emotion. Really extraordinary thing to see.
And then she also makes these kind of mixed media paintings as well, which are just dazzling agglomerations of like paint and found materials, and having her explain her process for one element of one of these paintings was kind of incredible. Like involved like preserving this piece of organic matter of like over the course of a year, then she could use it in the painting. I don't know.
Incredibly, it was fantastic at the Ragtag Cinema, the Uprise Bakery, this sort of hub of Columbia and the festival. They actually brought in numerous of those works and hung them on the walls. So it was just so great to be able to have that right there.
That's great.
The work that you're describing did not make it. It requires a lot of maintenance, and apparently that didn't make it to the wall.
So yeah, that's Flying Lessons, Elizabeth Nichols. And maybe that can lead us into a pair of films actually that dealt with, how you face the end of the road.
Yeah, there were triune films about aging or end of life, and all three could be really funny. Another one is I Like It Here by filmmaker Ralph Arlick, who's in the late 70s when he made it, and I think he's in his 80s now. He made a film called Following Sean about 20 years or so ago. That's the film that sort of made its way out there that some folks may have seen. But he's a kind of first-person filmmaker of a certain mode, of a certain generation, like your Ross McElwees and Rob Mosses. And this film, I forget where it premiered. From what I gather, it's played mostly at Jewish film festivals around, not a whole lot of sort of high-profile places. And I know this was among the favorites from the programming team, and for good reason. I just was totally taken with this. It even like starts with like he provides a voiceover that from the very start is arch and funny and full of basically one-liners, where he's trying to figure out what movie he's making, and he thinks it's going to be about an elderly neighbor, and then it winds up being a lot more about himself and his friends, and they explore the reality of being a changing person with a changing brain and changing body, and uses that as an opportunity to tell a little bit of his story, his love lives, his marriage, as well as the lives of his family, and goes in a lot of different directions, covers a lot of ground, but never makes it feel like an arduous thing, never feels overly structured. So as an audience, we need structure to some degree, and it may be helpful to even sort of get a sense of what the structure is while we're watching. I feel like Ralph finds a way of making you grateful for the fact that it could go anywhere, mostly because he has this voice that you don't begrudge. Like, you don't wish that there was no voiceover. You actually want that voice to come back. You want him to give us a sense of where he's landing amidst all this, especially if we're talking to his friends and colleagues and family. We want to sort of know where he is with all of this. It's just a really lovely, quite profound film in the end by, a filmmaker who really, really knows how to make a first person documentary. The other one is Obsolete, very different approach. Samira Roy, about a couple in Mumbai who, from the very, very beginning, announced that they want to die, that they feel like they're old enough. I think he's around 90, she's around early 80s, she's a little bit ill. Nothing is sort of imminent in terms of their demise, it seems, but they go public with the idea that they wished that it was legal, euthanasia was legal there. And the film is basically Samira Roy filming them in their tiny little tenement apartment, their day-to-day, their rituals, their rapport, and it just almost so implicitly embracing the tedium of them being old and done and bored. At the same time, as I found that incredibly engrossing and wonderful and enviable in so many ways. So it's very much, both at the same time, where you're sympathetic to the fact that there's nothing necessarily that they're living for, that they really feel like they live full lives, and yet their relationship, their rapport, their gallows humor, their negging each other is pretty joyful to watch. And he's quite old and really just seems tired all the time, and seems put upon at all times. And she is easy to laugh and finds him funny still, but also is like clearly had it with him too. It's like, 60 years with somebody. It sounds wonderful, but after a while, like, I think it just gets a bit, enough. So yeah, I don't know. I found it pretty delightful while also being obviously quite heavy. Sense of mortality is hanging very heavily over all of it.
Well, I'm curious to watch both of those. I think I remember seeing, speaking of the I Like It Here director Ralph Arlick, I remember a follow-up he made in the 2000s. I think I had to write a capsule about very early in my reviewing career.
Okay.
Well, maybe we can take just like a 90-degree turn or whatever to something different. Sperm World.
Yeah.
I don't know anything about that one, but I remember the director Lance Oppenheim's feature, Some Kind of Heaven, about like old folks in Florida, if I remember correctly.
So Lance Oppenheim made Some Kind of Heaven, and this is his follow-up feature, and it is akin. Sperm World is definitely akin with Some Kind of Heaven. I mean, I remember really liking Some Kind of Heaven because it comes on like something that's going to be, it's about a retirement community in Florida, and it comes on as being a bit full of itself and maybe a bit too clever and a little bit too like kind of just getting into what's so absurd about that environment, which is genuinely absurd. But I actually found that the relationships with the subjects, the sort of chosen subject, to be genuine and moved by them. And I just like the idea of a very young, you know, early 20-something filmmaker finding an affinity with older people, being kind of what worked for me in that film.
Yeah.
But it very much knows, I think, which is very, I think, a high level thing to do for a young filmmaker, knows it's writing a line there. You know, it's not stepping away from that line. It's kind of embracing that line. And Sperm World does also, in this situation, you're following a handful of people around who work or have benefited from the kind of alternative sperm community, sperm donation community, I should say, where it's not clinics, it's either people donating sperm or making some amount of money off of it. But, you know, people who just donate on the side. There's a one gentleman who does this for free as almost like a sort of spiritual act, and is in a marriage with somebody when they haven't had a kid, but he's donating to many others. And there's that. Then there's an older man who decides to get into this. And I think there's some profit that he has at some times, but in this one case that's followed, he donates to a younger woman who's suffering from an illness that will probably take her earlier than most, but really, really wants to have a kid. And so he's trying to help her, and they're both trying to navigate maybe any expectations of, now that they know each other, there being any kind of relationship, which doesn't develop, but there's some tensions there. Hmm. And then there's another gentleman who is like the most prolific sperm donor you could ever fathom. And not only donates sperm on the reg, he also wants to father them all. And so he travels around the world thinking of himself as a father to all of them, and tries to support and parent dozens upon dozens of children around. And he's an absolutely fascinating person.
Wow.
Whose motivations are never, ever really that clear, even though we spend a lot of time with him and his weirdo friend. Anyway, so this is the sort of thing we're talking about. And it's beautifully shot, pungently shot, where it's clear that at all times there's got to be a real complicity and collaboration to make these shots happen. And some of it's very much reading letters aloud that are performed, but you're also looking at pretty extreme behavior in extreme situations that it's hard not to be slack-jawed the entire time as well. So you're kind of just in that line again between, where is this film coming from? Are we laughing at these people? Are we identifying with them? Are they identifying with the filmmaker? Like, you're just kind of in that space. And I just find it to be far more compelling and persuasive than I expect it to be. And just like, you know, some kind of heaven, I found myself more on the side of being kind of fascinated and grateful and thinking a lot about these people.
I mean, it's also sounds like a movie that kind of plays with the idea of what we expect a documentary on the subject to be, just in the sense that, you know, is this a display of like narcissism or what?
Oh, it absolutely comes up. No, 100%. No, I mean, the guy who donates prolifically and fathers prolifically, Ari is his name, seems very much like real altruistic tendencies, but also incredible ego to feel like he can or should be a father figure to these kids.
Yeah. I would be entirely unsurprised if it made its way to theaters.
Well, actually, it's weird. It's an FX film. It is going to make its way to FX by the end of the month.
I will catch up with that, I guess, on FX. But I've just been kind of throwing out some titles here. I should just straight up ask, what's something you saw that, you know, you also want to talk about that you really liked? I'm thinking about There Was Not.
Another world premiere, another film like Flying Lessons that was long in development, is There Was Not by Emily Mertitian, maybe Mertitian. And this is a film about the Artsakh region, a disputed territory between Armenia, or among Armenia and Azerbaijan. The film begins during a period during which Artsakh was an independent state. And we get to know various women women who live there, their lives, a little bit about the culture. The filmmaker, Emily, is also Armenian and family is from the Artsakh region. And so she's very much a presence in the film in terms of there's a warmth between the subject and the material we're seeing. But she's, you know, she's not super present because there's so much to watch in terms of these women's lives. But around halfway through the film is when fighting resumes in 2020, a sort of quick and deadly conflict develops in which the region is mostly taken over by Azerbaijan, and their lives change significantly. Some of the women remain for some of that time in Artsakh. Eventually, they start fleeing to Armenia and live a life in exile. So there is very much a before and after structure to the film, and it's very, very, very difficult to watch these people go through this. You know, I feel like that though is very, very specific and important story, it's hard not to watch that and relate that to experiences right now, experiences in recent history, experiences, you know, that are just filled with dislocation and exile and a real serious worry about life ever resuming in any normal way.
Yeah.
It's a lyrical film with quite a lot of joy to it. And the women are fascinating in different ways because they're of different ages. But yeah, I mean, no doubt about it that it's a really tough place that it lands.
Yeah, definitely. And this is one that I have seen, and it's like a documentary where the expected story kind of goes off the rails, or is just like, I mean, blown off the rails, basically, because it seems it's going to be following three or four women in their careers or starting new directions in their careers. There's one woman who's running for some sort of like position. Mm-hmm. And so she's campaigning. And then there's another woman who, she was like a counselor, and then another who works for like a peace organization removing mines.
Yeah. Yeah.
Was there a fourth person?
Yeah, the judo champion.
Oh, God, how could I forget? Yeah, who, yeah, as you mentioned, you know, is a younger generation. You know, she's hoping to go to the Olympics. You also meet her own grandmother, who seems, you know, just tough. They just seem like different generations of tough. Yes. Together. I really love when you see them together. But their trajectories that you think that you'd follow, this kind of documentary arc of intertwining trajectories, yeah, are just knocked off their axis. And then you see them, their different ways they are resilient and maybe sometimes aren't or can't.
Yeah.
You see maybe like the politician maybe wobbling a little at first. It makes it a more raw and candid documentary than it might have seemed to be, because I'm sure they also expected it would just be a chronicle of what they were going to be doing. In a sense, I just felt like it was any person watching could then just reflect how would I react, you know?
Totally. Right. Would you want to stay with your home? Would you feel like you have to leave your home? Would you go fight? You know, would you, the counselor is a wonderful character in person, goes from sort of counseling folks in kind of normal times to counseling people in exile like she is, you know, working that kind of a different type of transition. And the folks that she had been counseling back in normal times were often people who are older, people who are dealing with going from sort of Soviet rule to independent rule and that adjustment that was still ongoing. But then all of a sudden that becomes rendered moot. And just thinking through that, right? Thinking about people who lived through such a significant change in nationhood and personhood and autonomy, and then have that changed yet again. Like, I just think, like, what do you do with the memories from your childhood or from your younger life that have the third or fourth different reality than the one you're living in? How do you even just relate to yourself after a while? Really just tough stuff. Sosei is the judo champion, and she's the one who actually goes to war.
Yeah.
You know, so we see her filming as she's like in barrack in trenches, and, you know, seeing that fight that she has just get sort of like drained out of her, because it's just so brutal. What and she's so young, you know, we wind up with her necessarily pulling back from competition because of how challenging the rest of life is.
She just gets kind of hardened in a way.
Yeah.
And but, you know, survives at the same time, which is no small feat. It's a movie that it does have this stopped short feeling, you know. It's a history that's been deflated, which places these impossible burdens on these people.
Yeah.
And then the whole like geopolitics of it, and Russia's involvement is like these faux peacekeepers, and then it's just disgusting.
Yep.
And this comes up with a movie 1489, I think, is the same region, right?
It's same region, same conflict, where the filmmaker's brother is the one who goes off to war and is missing.
Yeah.
And we talked about that out of IDFA.
We did, yeah. And, you know, same thing. That movie is just devastating. I mean, in a totally different way.
Absolutely, no. I would encourage folks to see both of these films, because it's hard to imagine that too many people, unless you are your families from that region, know the details of this. And it's been quite valuable that having this illuminated for you in these two films. Very, very different and complement each other, I think. 1489 is more of a kind of a home movie that becomes something much more. That was in True False and is also going to be in First Look indeed next week.
Yeah. Yeah. This region is woefully undercovered.
Totally.
Like a number of regions in the world, but just, yeah. Just want to mention one more film out of True False, and then I want to ask you about some movies in First Look. And that one I can talk a little bit about, because I've also seen this one. It's called A Photographic Memory, mm-hmm. from Rachel Elizabeth Seed. I mean, it's actually kind of interesting to pair it a little with, put it in the lineage of the kind of personal essay, you know, like Ralph Ehrlich, like you were mentioning.
Yeah.
It's this kind of journey of self-discovery by way of her mother, who was also, you know, an artist. And in a very interesting way, like a photographer talking to photographers. Sheila Turner Seed is her mother. You know, she's basically trying to find out information about her mother, because her mother died when she, the filmmaker, was just 18 months old. And that means that she turns out to like recognize her voice and have that kind of trigger feelings. But other things she learns about her are new to her, even to the extent of like seeing footage of them together, you know, her as like a baby, a toddler with her mom, and not remembering, actively remembering those scenes. That's kind of the movement of the movie, is her reflecting on that and finding all these similarities and tracing her mother's career as a highly successful and independent and smart and fun also and funny photographer, mm-hmm. at a time when very few female photographers in the industry. So doubly challenging, although she doesn't really, I hardly get the sense ever, you know, you hear excerpts from her diary, but she just really seems to have been a force of nature, going to places that were challenging for, even if you weren't trying to like carve out a career in like a male dominated, like Egypt during like a turnover of government, or furthest reaches of Alaska and those sort of things. So it's a movie with, has this kind of embarrassment of riches in terms of those like primary materials, those photographs, those interviews with the likes of like Henri Cartier-Bresson, mm-hmm. basically like defining the decisive moment in her audio interview with him and things like this. So I found it like a movie that I'm sure audiences really respond to well, because everyone has some experience like this of learning something about your parent and identifying with some and finding parallels between where you are as an adult. Because I guess, you know, this took place over like 10 years of filming and crafting,
yeah.
coming across some of the same challenges.
You're saying like the ways of identifying, you're right. Like I was thinking a lot about finding materials authored by or featuring my parents and trying to understand them better, and how powerful that is and how confusing that is. And this is just on another level, right? Because you're talking about like, she didn't know her mother at all. You know, there's pictures of her with her mother, but she says in it, like, I have no memory of this. And like, who is this kid? And so to have your entire impression of a parent, you know, exhumed from this material is very much next level in terms of that desire to get to know your parents.
Yeah. And, you know, the movie just regularly has these charges of energy to it when you hear her mother interviewing someone, because she's just like this incredible interviewer.
Yeah.
You know, just has this kind of casual way of asking the most like profound questions and sussing out, you know, exactly what she should be at, to the point where one person she talks to is like, you know exactly what to ask that I don't know how to answer. so I kind of love that.
Well, and she looks so much like her mother, and that becomes a
thing, yeah.
too, where subjects who knew her mother, just it's clear on their faces how kind of almost spooked they are to be asked to sort of revisit this when they're looking at somebody who looks just like her.
In that sense, like, I mean, the movie has a kind of organic emotional quality in that you're seeing her respond to these things, respond to this experience of reflecting and all these interesting parallels. And it's like well orchestrated. I don't mean that in a bad way, but it's definitely, that's why I think an audience would respond well to it. I also think that there's a certain narrative to it, or idea in it, which is the kind of stasis that's involved in retracing these steps. You know, her mother, who's hugely successful, like this huge figure. I mean, her father was also like a photographer and is like this sort of funny, sad figure. But yeah, that was something that intrigued me, which is, I don't know if that's like an anxiety that's in it. I don't know if that is really in it because it's such an appreciative and kind of curious and loving approach. But there is something about that that does loom. I don't know.
I think you're right. I think you're right. And I would hazard to say that it's intentional or understood to some degree. But also, regardless, like to be in this position of the present tense, looking back, you know, animating, understanding, keeps bringing you back to a present that's stuck in the looking back to the past. Right. So I just feel like there is, you said, you sort of set certain stasis to it that I think is unavoidable. And in some ways, my favorite part of the film is at the end when it kind of faces that. Where it's like, okay, I feel like I got somewhere. I think the last words of the film are something like, now what? Like, what's next? You know, did as much as possible to understand and revisit her mother's life and all that attended to it. And there comes a point where it has to remain incomplete, and you have to move on or face other things. I find that stasis of it may be frustrating at times in the film, but also probably unavoidable. And what makes it cathartic at the end, I think, you know, is not just this. It's not a deliverance or a catharsis. It's more of like a, okay, all right, got it. Have to have a present tense that sort of moves it, you know, at a different pace now.
No, I think that's true. So I think that might be a good place to, you know, obviously there are more films at True False, but I really want to talk about a couple films that I've been previewing for First Look that's coming up. We were saying before, like a number of these movies are ones that have come up on this podcast already. So if any listeners have been, you know, frustrated at any point about like, ah, I can't see this film, you're talking about a really interesting film. I don't know, like 10 of these interesting films that have come up on the podcast at various festival podcasts are showing in First Look. A few of them, I think you and I talked about specifically. 1489 being one of those. And The Echo, I know, has come up on the podcast, the Tatiana Huso movie, and Behind Closed Doors, really interesting one about the audio of like the planned takeover of the government in which country again?
Brazil.
Brazil. So that's cool. The movie, not the planned takeover of the government, but plenty of things like that.
I think you and Edo talked about The Clinic out of IDFA as well. Edo
Yeah, that's
was a
true.
curator of film at the museum. And I think An Evening Song for Three Voices, you also discussed previously.
Yes, that came up just recently in the one of the Berlin podcasts.
Yeah, I want to hear what you have to say about Nits Island.
Yeah, one movie that I've seen that definitely not talked about is Nits Island. By, I guess, a trio of French filmmakers. And this kind of harkens us back a little bit to We Met in Virtual Reality, which you and I talked about and also interviewed that director of that, in the sense that it's a documentary that is, you know, recorded entirely within, you know, like a virtual world or like a game world. The game specifically is called Days with a Z. It's a game of post-apocalyptic survival. But, you know, also, I guess, as with so many games, just a game where people just hang out. And they approach it, they really put you next to them as filmmakers going around asking questions and, you know, what do you think of this? What do you think of that? And then slowly, as they get closer to the various people, players who are in the game, doing things with them, going on weird hikes. This is a movie that just, in that sense, also just keeps changing because it starts out with, you know, almost like this news documentary where they're in this world and there's no mic they're thrusting at people, but it has that sense of like, you know, what do you like about this world? What do you hope for the future? You know, this and that. And then it turns into something different as it goes along. In a sense, it seems like overdetermined because it's this post-apocalyptic world. So it seems like it would be, you know, oh, I should mention that the Z is for zombies, I guess, essentially. So occasionally you'll just hear this almost comically, this cartoonish, like, blah, of a zombie just who has to be killed or is being killed in the background.
Well, your filmmakers, on top of having to figure out how to make a documentary in this space, have to then kill zombies on their
Exactly.
way to making the movie,
Right.
which is definitely un you know unprecedented in documentary film.
They have like a three-person crew. One is like the main interviewer guy, one is the cameraman, and one is the quote unquote technician. But that also just means his job is to like, massacre zombies that are about to come kill them and interrupt the shoot. And I like that it's also not a coy setup. It's not like coy about that what it's doing. I mean, it's pretty matter of fact that they are these filmmakers. They embrace it. There's no one like questioning the whole premise of it really, which I think is good. Also, I mean, it's kind of a gorgeous movie. It starts off, I think, more or less with like a montage of landscapes that could be establishing shots, And I kind of had to think, this is so photorealistic. Do they animate it, or how is it drawn from an actual like photograph of like a field or something? I mean that, but then as soon as you see the people, it's as glitchy as people are in these games.
And I felt the same way about we went and broke to reality, right? You have to kind of figure out what your terms are. And then that dictates so much of the character of the thing that develops. And I feel like they chose a game that is like 10 years old. And so by choosing a game that's 10 years old, you get, I think, a glitchier presentation. Like this is not brand new technology that went into this game. But you also, that means, and this sort of goes with what you're saying in terms of you can't get past the fact that this is like a apocalyptic, is it's not very populated. Like the people that are there have been there for a long time and they're there to be part of this community. It's not the sort of game that a lot of new people are signing up for. And so you get these vacant landscapes as being just part of what they're finding. And they're kind of searching for people sometimes for days at a time, hours at a time. The filmmakers go into this platform to find somebody to talk to. And then they do. And then that, oh, there's a community, there are friends, and it gets from there. But I feel like they made a choice to make the film in a game that has a longer history so that it, well, A, it's not promo, but B, it's also not where you're seeing a lot of new people kind of cramming in there.
Yeah, that's a really good thing to mention. And I also just want to say it's not just like the novelty of being in this world, because this gets more and more common. Like in documentary, I think now Ibelin at Sundance, obviously was another kind of twist on this, and seems to have really struck a lot of people too. This movie opens out into kind of basically turns into like a reflection on mortality, I guess, and identity and virtual versus real world. Part of it takes place during the pandemic. You realize from conversations and people, again, people don't question the premise, but they do talk openly about the divergence between the time in the game and the time in real life and what they're spending time away from. There's this very charming couple who talk about, with some trepidation about where that could potentially lead when this kind of world is so easy to completely immerse yourself in to the exclusion of the rest of the world. So that's a big part of it as well, and an effective part too. And then just one other kind of like philosophical aspect to it is one of the first groups that they talk to and they do not stick with, but is left in there for a reason, is kind of like the dystopian version of what this world allows. I mean, on the one hand, it's just this completely escapist band of people who are, I mean, they're playing it as a game. They're having fun because they get to shoot people and, or like capture prisoners and toy with them and practice cannibalism, which is sounds really extreme for a while. And then I realized, oh yeah, it's just a game, so it's not that extreme. But the filmmakers continue just to put a little pressure on that and allow you to kind of extrapolate. Well, maybe it is just a little weird how much these people enjoy this. And when you ask them questions about what the future might be like, even granting that it's an escapist game, and if you're not even trying to think about that, it feels somehow symbolic or allegorical when they're like, we don't really care. I don't care. We just like be able to do whatever the hell we want. It feels like this terrible microcosm of a certain
Yes, it does.
frame of
It
mind.
yeah. No, there's a nihilist impulse that's being played out, which I was not led to believe that there's lack of nihilism in whoever those people's lives are outside of the game.
Yeah. I always want to leave like more of the movie for people to discover, because it does keep kind of changing and surprising you in where it goes. But that's Nits Island. And one other movie I did get to preview also is Magic Mountain. And that is, I mean, in a way, actually very much an allegorical movie, pretty openly,
Yeah,
openly
literally.
so. It's a Georgian film, Georgian filmmaker. And she's filming this basically TB sanitarium.
Yep.
that was originally built for like a Romanov Russian prince. It basically ends up like paralleling eras of history, like Soviet around Soviet history. But the substance of the movie is her kind of hanging out with the people who are there. And it seems basically a place that almost seems to double as like this, it's sanitarium, but maybe also asylum. It sort of feels like people who have TB, but also maybe have like given up on life or been given up upon. So it's kind of a little tough to watch, even though they've kind of find their own rhythm and backgammon powered way of life. But yeah, it's a shortish dark feature, so I don't know, 75-ish minutes. It has its own melancholy arc.
The filmmaker had tuberculosis.
Oh yeah, key point.
Key point, but it's less about revisiting a place where she lived, but more about the reality of what tuberculosis had meant for other people and what it meant historically. And it plays this really bizarre trick, and it's not a trick, it's the reality of it, but where you are immersed in this, this is an impressive building, and it's great to be led into a structure like that and be able to sort of, it's very cinematic, but at the same time, it's hard not to feel like it's a depressing place, right? Because these are people trapped and stuck here or forgotten. But over time, you also see this genuine relationships they have with each other and with the nursing staff and the doctors, and kind of like a whole world emerges for you. Instead of it being kind of something that you can't wait to leave, it becomes a place that you then live with and feel things about the place and of course the people. And then it changes into something that, because it's there's a dreamy quality to it, I think you alluded to, and it's sort of told from the future, and also it's told in conversation with the sanatorium, that it lands somewhere where what you've been watching is actually the past or the somewhat recent past, and the game, the rules have changed, and it becomes a place that it is itself a memory, and makes you, in at least my experience of it, was then kind of went back through the film and my mind and kind of have a different emotional response to it. Rather than it being a really fascinating setting for a film, it then became, oh no, this is way better than what's coming next. This is so much more humane, or there's a possibility of connection and community here, which is going to be lost because the world's going to change yet again, and we're not even going to have this level of care and accommodation for people in this position.
That's really beautiful how you put that. I mean, that really rings true for me. I mean, this movie really gets at the attachment you can have to something imperfect, to some place imperfect, a place you didn't choose. Obviously, you know that they obviously, having contracted TB, they did not there was not their choice, and they end up there, but they all have that attachment to it. And it is interesting how it's addressed. There's this voiceover that's addressed to the sanitarium, which has this really evocative name. So I've, obviously at first thought, oh, that's a person or someone from her past or something like that. And it opens, I actually, it occurred to me while I was watching it, it opens with this very trance-like kind of drive up to the place, that actually is sort of similar to the opening of Who by Fire, a film that was at the Berlin Film Festival. That's going to mean something to about two people, but trust me, it's a really potent way of beginning it. Also, this very deliberate kind of trance-like camera movements that partly are like the car is tracking shot and then continued as you're moving in the holes. But after that, you kind of are just sitting with people. But yeah, it's something quite interesting. Magic Mountain, I guess technically you can put it alongside some other films that have come out of Georgia, getting at something sort of both like hyper real and otherworldly somehow.
It is like hard to compare the number of great, interesting, unique films that have come out of Georgia for such a small country in the last bit of time. And bears mentioning for those who are not aware that the relationship between the current government and artists is very much strained, and the production, the pipeline for funding these films has been pretty much stripped away at the moment. So I know that filmmakers are banding together, trying to sort of raise awareness of that, but it is really, really frustrating to think about how many of these great films, maybe we may not get them in the coming years because of that political reality, which is also related. You're saying, think about the films Taming the Garden from a few years ago, From My Love from a few years ago. This film has a direct connection because that's about this unseen oligarch who's buying up trees from around the country to put them in his own absurd playground is the same oligarch who basically comes into play at the end of this film in terms of buying up the property where the sanitarium exists.
Yeah. So yeah, like this turning of eras. So yeah, I hope people see Magic Mountain, which again, I have mentioned, but a number of these documentaries really crucial to see in a theater because, in this case, the structure of the building and being in that space, I feel, must be pretty potent in a theater.
Yeah, definitely.
So that is Magic Mountain, which has two filmmakers behind it, Mariam Chachia and Nick Voigt.
Mm-hmm.
And Abbas Dumani is the name of the sanitarium / former palace / future site of oligarch pleasure dome. That brings us to one more title in First Look that I had not seen and was curious to hear about because it just sounded pretty cool. And that's Achilles. That one is an Iranian film, I believe.
Yeah, it's a debut feature by Farhad Dalaram and premiered in Toronto last September and hasn't been shown too much since then, which I'm not going to dwell on that, but shocking to me because to me it's a pretty major film. Very distinctive approach and distinctive voice. Certainly not what you would expect from whatever you might expect from Iranian narrative filmmaking. Sort of nothing hybrid-like about it. It sort of toys with genre to some degree, sort of toys with kind of creepy thriller, then gets into maybe the paranormal, maybe then gets into a road movie, and then winds up being intimations of a love story, but then winds up being much more of a political film than you might have realized once the sort of the background and the context of the characters becomes clear. It's about a man who works in a Tehran hospital, but also sleeps at the hospital and seems to spend all of his time in the hospital. It becomes apparent later that he's actually separated from a partner and seems to be hiding away from some things in the past. Encounters a woman in the psych ward who intrigues him, and it's sort of not even apparent why she does so much. And then it gets into his mind to get her outside the hospital because she hasn't been outside at all. And then once he does so, they find themselves on the lam, as it were, and goes from there. And don't want to spoil that for those who are able to sort of join us or see the film further down the line. But I will say it gets to a point where it's really not allegorical at all. It's not really finding ways of skirting around the censorship, laws in Iran, and winds up going really straight for it and winds up being a pretty direct and I would say angry, but also kind of inspiring place. Farhad no longer lives in Iran, really sort of went straight forward here. He had been imprisoned himself. So there's something very, very personal that's sort of informing this, but it is really bracing film. Like, it's the sort of thing where you don't expect to be able to see something so distinct coming out of Iran at the moment, because you're either seeing something from someone in exile or you're seeing somebody who's dancing around what can and can't be shown and said. Mm. But instead, there's a film made within the country that is really makes no bones about where it's coming from.
Yeah.
Real dissident film from within the country.
Yeah, I had no idea that the filmmaker had actually been in prison there. That's pretty amazing. Yeah, this is one I'll just say I'd started watching and have to finish. At the very beginning, I had some like vague like Kiyoshi Kurosawa vibes when they're in the...
Totally, yeah. Yeah. It just keeps, like, I think I was telling you, like, keeps, it feels like different versions of movies keep coming through, and it being, to me, like, really legitimate because it winds up being the points of view of the two main characters that kind of changes the math.
And then the way you're talking about it in terms of sort of flirting with different genres, but then basically being overtaken by the sort of inevitability of becoming a political narrative, which is something that I feel with some recent Iranian films. Like I saw one in the Berlinale called My Favorite Cake, which is this sort of ostensibly feel good comic drama about an older woman, a widow, getting her groove back or sort of, is what you sort of think it's going to happen. But it just constantly encroaching on that narrative is like, the fact that her neighbors are like spying on her and mm-hmm. that she can't mm-hmm. be seen with this, taxi driver that she wants to get to know mm-hmm. and stuff like that. Yeah, and then there's one other Iranian movie that was coming out that I thought had been lost to the ages from a year or two ago. I wish I could remember the title. Do you know this one? It's basically like 15 like blackout sketches, more or less.
No, I don't know if I do.
But yeah, so I'm intrigued to finish Achilles.
It's actually not the only Iranian. We are showing I was alluding to films made in exile, but there's a film called What Did You Dream Last Night, Parajanov, which just premiered in Rotterdam. And it's this filmmaker, Firas Shahraki, who shot Alexander Kobrydze's What Do We See When We Look at the Sky, as all and also Arthur and Diana, another narrative film in First Look. But anyway, it's his basically communicating with his Iranian parents who are in Iran from afar, and in a sense, it seems like it's going to be entirely a Zoom film, which those films can be a little bit hard to find your way into, especially after seeing so much Zoom footage in the pandemic. But then winds up kind of collapsing those expectations, and winds up being kind of an attempt by really unemotive family members to find ways of connecting with one another, considering they seem a little bit emotionally restricted. Lovely, lovely, lovely piece. But yeah, point is making a film from that sense of exile.
So those are a few films in First Look, and as I was saying in the beginning, some of the ones like Flying Lessons that we were talking about before also are in First Look. And like I said, I don't know why I'm so tickled by this, but I guess it's just neat to me that people can see all these movies that I've been talking about from past festivals. And I mean,
Yeah.
again, if you are in New York.
Everything we're showing is New York premieres. That's, be that what it is, but there's nothing about what we're doing here that we're looking to be exclusive. We're certainly hoping these films get a wider play in the US and other festivals pay attention, and maybe some New York distributors take a look at films that they didn't see previously, or get a chance to see them with an audience where that might change the perceptions of some of this stuff. So not everything, plays as well on the laptop as it plays in the room. So
Yeah,
yeah.
well, I'll just volunteer one that jumps to mind for that, which of course is Mammy Wata. I think opened the last year's edition, is that right?
Closed. It closed First Look last year.
Close
Yeah.
which is, just this incredible black and white cinematography that absolutely right, was interesting on the laptop. I mean, an understating already, but yeah, on the big screen was pretty incredible.
And I could say that for this year, that a version of that is The Featherweight, the Rob Kolodny's film, which premiered at Venice, that we're showing as a showcase on Saturday, which I'd seen it a few times in a couple different versions, and seeing it on the big screen and sort of understanding that it's a sort of based on a true story boxing film, but also is shot like a 1965 observational narrative film. But like I would say, of all the films in the festival, there's something that's very kind of big screen movie kineticism involved there, that you always want to be in a room for something like that. So I'm excited to show that there.
Yeah, and I mean, along those lines, it just reminds me because that was a Venice title, as you mentioned. Was Gasoline Rainbow also?
Gasoline Rainbow is our closing night film, and that premiered in Venice as well.
Right, yeah, the Ross Brothers. I suspect a movie that will be quite fun to watch with a crowd.
It is, and I saw that with the crowd in IDFA, and I'm so glad that I saw it there. I saw it on the biggest screen there, the I1, but also like was kind of taken by how many young people were there and were kind of like having a great time with it. Was ho hoping that there's, for Sunday evening and Astoria, Queens, who knows how many what the demographics are going to be, but I do feel like there's something that young people are reacting to with that film. So it'd be cool to have a room full of college students or post grads. Bill and Turner will be there, and the producers are all going to be there, but I don't think any of the actors are going to show up. They will have just shown it South by Southwest, and so who knows? Maybe the movable feast continues and they'll show up with us.
Yeah.
Be great. Yeah.
And then one other thing that I thought was kind of neat, you're gonna have Mary Lampson there.
We are, yes, yeah. Well, we have these 3 days of work in progress presentations and conversations called Working on It. And on the Friday session, the great film editor Mary Lampson will be there in conversation with Marlee McDonough, who's also a great young editor who also directed Time Bomb Y2K and edited the or co-edited the Eno documentary from this year. Yeah, they'd never met each other, so they're going to have a public conversation, and the work in progress there is that Mary's been working on a book on a book on editing and about her life in editing, which I've been privileged to see some versions of over time, and it's getting to the point where she's starting to ready to sort of take it to the next step. So I think having a conversation about that and the parallels between writing a book and editing a movie that she sees and has experienced.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah, and just so I mean, Harlan County, USA,
Yes.
Painter's Painting, Millhouse.
Yeah.
What's more recent?
So Crip Camp is the
Yes,
film
correct.
most associated with. So over the last several years, she's based in Maine and has been doing less primary editing and being more of a consulting editor or supervisory editor. So she's got credits that like Crip Camp, where that's the case. And last year's
A still small voice.
exactly, yes. And a Still Small Voice from last year, the Doc shortlisted film.
So anyway, yeah, just nerding out on a big film
Yeah.
editor.
I've known Mary for a while, and she can be a shy person, so it's I've not been able to bring her out to date, but I think the fact that she's excited about the book and where it's at means that we get a chance to host her, and I'm very glad for
Very cool.
that.
All right, well, I can bring things in for a landing there. So that's been True False from the past weekend. And coming up, starting March 13th, first look at the Museum of the Moving Image. Eric, thank you. And now I'll let you catch up on sleep again from True False.
Thank you, Nick. And look forward to seeing you and anybody else who can come out, and also look forward to seeing you at True False next year. We've got to rectify the situation and do this on location next year.
Yeah, I'll have to do a pull a gasoline rainbow and get there somehow.
Boats, trains, cars, whatever it takes, get out there.
You've been listening to The Last Thing I Saw with host Nicholas Rapold. You can support the podcast by signing up at rapold.substack.com. Thank you for listening.